This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, April 19th, the Falling Piano Edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm an editor at Slate, and I'm the father of Eliza, age 7, and Leo, who is 3 3/4.
My name is Carvel Wallace. I'm a writer and podcaster out in Oakland, California, and I'm the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 15.
I'm Marlo Mack. I'm a podcaster in Seattle. I'm the mother of Em, who is a 10-year-old girl.
Marlo is the host of How to Be a Girl. It's a great podcast about life with Em, her transgender daughter. Rebecca will be back next week. Today on our show, we've got a question from a mom whose transgender son wants to start taking testosterone over his father's objections. And then we will hear from two parents who want to know if they can leave their 18-month-old alone in the house in the middle of the night. Should be an interesting show. Plus, as always, we will have triumphs and fails. We'll have recommendations. And on Slate Plus, senior editor Sam Adams will join us to share a rock and roll parenting triumph. First up, triumphs and fails, the moment when we share a triumph or a fail from the past week of our parenting life. Carvel, you want to go first?
So, yeah, I have a triumph, which is that I kind of teased this last time. Listeners to the show will know that over spring break, I took my son on a road trip to Oregon to see two plays in the Ashland, Oregon Shakespeare Festival. We saw Othello and Henry V, and he really liked Othello, but he was bored to tears by Henry V, which is not a great play, but it was a great production. Anyway, so it was supposed to be like this father-son bonding trip, and like he's 15, and we're definitely like at, you know, there's some headbutting in our relationship. Like there's definitely what's happening. It's not the only thing happening, but it's some of what's happening. And that trip was interesting because we sort of bickered for like the first maybe 8 hours of it. We got all of our bickering out of the way. And then we kind of dropped into this zone where we just started hanging out. And it was actually like, I thought it was really good. It seemed that we learned a lot about each other. And, you know, he's learning about me because he's seeing me in new eyes, and I'm learning about him because he's changing every minute. Teenagers are changing all the time, and, you know, the kid that you bonded with at 14 and a half is not the same as the kid that you bond with at 15 and 3 months. It's just like they're different people. And so I got to see some things about him that I hadn't fully realized until I saw them in an extended enclosed space for a long period of time, and it gave me some wisdom about how to deal with him. And I think, you know, I just think it felt good. And we bonded, and it was all the stuff. And the music and the movies and the whole thing, it was just cool. And so so we came back, and then I was just checking to see if I felt like there had been any improvement in our relationship. And for the first few days, I couldn't tell. And then over the last few days, I've just noticed something. And it's hard to put a finger on it, but it feels like something. It feels like he seems slightly older than he was a week ago in terms of his, like, the way he's thinking about himself and what he's doing in the world. And people will know that, like, the mornings are a major issue with our family, and Ezra is dealing with a lot of executive functioning stuff. And that's compounded by this feeling of, like, why even try? Because what's the point? And, you know, and it's just this, everyone gets frustrated. And, you know, we're post-frustrated now. We don't even get into it anymore. We're just sort of like, this is what it is. But lately, I feel like I've noticed that he's trying different stuff in the morning. He's getting up a little earlier. He finally, like, on his own, decided to put his shoes on before he leaves the house, which I realize sounds to the average listener like, really? Your kid's 15 and he's still doing that? But he had this whole theory about how he should come to the car, shoes off, and then put his shoes on in the car, and how that would save time. But it never did, because then we'd get to the front of his school and he wouldn't have started, and we'd be waiting like 5 minutes for him to tie his shoes in front of the school, and it would just this whole thing. The point is, he's doing all this stuff ever so slightly differently. And I can't put my finger on it, but everything just feels different. And he had a French test today, and he got out of the car and he said, wish me luck. And I was like, on what? He was like, I have a French test today. I have to make it up because I bombed it the first time. And I have to my teacher said I could retake it at lunch. And I said, did you study? And he said, no, that's why I bombed it. No, I said, for the second time, did you study? And he said, yeah. And I was like, wow, he studied. He actually cares about what he gets on this test, which again is new territory. This is not the Ezra that we were seeing like as recently as 3 months ago. And I don't know, I think it's a lot of factors, but I can't help feeling like something did switch between us on that trip. And it just let out some of the tension in our relationship, which maybe let him focus more on his life as opposed to just like standing in opposition to me. And I don't know, but it just feels like a triumph. And I can't put my finger on it, but it feels good. And I'm happy about it. And yeah, so that's what I'm reporting this week.
That's awesome. Congratulations. I have a fail. It's around some of the same issues. So Eliza's much younger than Ezra, obviously. She's 7. But we are dealing with some of the same things. The morning is not easy for us either. Like all the getting ready to go to school and all of the things you have to do and keeping track of everything. She also is not great at like the executive function. And lately, you know, you can get into a pattern where like when all you're doing is like telling her to do things that you feel like she should by now know how to do by herself, and yet you have to keep instructing her to do it. And it's hard not to get frustrated, and it's hard to keep telling her to do these things without asking why she hasn't done it already, or why do I have to ask you 3 times every morning or whatever. And lately she's been sort of feeling down about like, well, I feel like I can't do anything right. And so we've been trying really hard just to ease up on her. And this morning we got into a thing and she was upset and saying, I can't do anything right. And my wife talked to her and calmed her down and made her feel better and reassured her. And then, you know, we got out the door and she was in a pretty good mood. We got out the door and we went to school. I took the two of them to school on the bus. And we got into we had a nice time on the bus, and we got into her classroom, and it feels like okay. We've had this difficult morning, but then we've set things back on the right path. And the main thing going on in her head is that she knows that we love her and we care about her, and the other stuff isn't that big a deal, and whatever. And then she, you know, says goodbye and goes off to play with her friends. And I'm like, wait, you didn't wash your hands? Because that's one of the things you have to do when you get to the classroom, is you have to go wash your hands. And she's like, okay. And she goes and washes her hands, but she doesn't use soap. And I just I'm just back there like I've been every single morning for the past year of like, you got to use the soap. Why? How many times do I have to tell you it's not washing your hands unless you use the soap? And that was just a tiny bit of soap and you rinsed it off before you even scrubbed your hands. Why are you, oh my goodness, why don't you know how to wash your hands properly? And I, of course, I didn't raise my voice like that in the classroom, but still, I had to keep pushing her to go. And like, I should have fucking let it go with the soap. I should have been like, okay, fine, go play with your friends. This is not the morning for me to re-instruct you about correct hygiene at the beginning of the school day. But I fell right back into the familiar pattern. And then she was like, all right, I'm washing my hands now. Fuck you. Go away. Basically, mm-hmm. She doesn't actually say that to me. She's 7. But that was how. Yeah.
She's looking at you.
She definitely feels it.
I just want to say that I relate to this so much. And I want to thank you for this because my experience with Ezra, and now that I'm getting some perspective on it, and we don't have this problem with Georgia, so in some ways that made it worse. But like, you identified this thing about the feeling that you have to tell them something that you've decided they should already know, and this long period after which you feel like they should know how to do something, and yet they're not doing it. And the deeper you get into that zone, the worse my parenting becomes. Because I get more and more frustrated. Yeah. And it took me so many years to realize that I don't fully know why they don't do the stuff that I think they should know how to do. But saying it over and over again doesn't make them do it. But it took me a really long time to realize that. And it does way more damage to our relationship, which is what I saw with Ezra, than it does make any progress with like hand washing or shoe tying or like clothes folding or whatever the thing is. It's like the progress is not worth the cost on any level, because adolescent parenting is so much about relationships because I've said this before, like they're out there, they're doing stuff. You need to have a working relationship with them because if your relationship with them is all conflict, then they won't come to you and they won't let you, you won't know what's going on in their lives. And that's when real problems can happen. So I just want to say to all the parents out there, like who feel like I showed you how to do this thing and it has been a year and you should know how to do it. And the fact that you can't do it is driving me crazy. And if I just maybe bring it with more force and attention and obsession, then finally you'll get how important it is. I just would advise that's not the path. It just isn't. And the negative impacts of that are long reaching and far reaging. And so don't go down that path. There are other reasons they're not doing the thing that you think they should know how to do. I don't know what all of them are. I do think a big percentage of it is like now you are the icon of that thing and they want to express their independence. So now they're specifically not doing it the way that you said. And they're working. I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But there's other stuff, too. I don't really get all of it. But I do know that like, if you think they should know how to do something and they're not doing it and you're pretty sure they should know how to do it, saying it more and more forcefully isn't the way to go. You do kind of have to let it go and preserve the larger thing, which is your communication and relationship with them.
Yeah, and instead of just hammering on at them about washing their hands, you have to fucking take them to Oregon for a Shakespeare festival.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's probably right. all right, Marlo, how about you? Triumph or fail?
I think it's a fail today.
All right, tell us.
My daughter is 10 years old and she's transgender. She told me when she was, basically as soon as she could talk, she told us that she was not the boy that we thought she was. And I spent a long and miserable and ridiculous year trying to convince her that she could just be a boy who liked princesses, any kind of boy she liked, and that all failed miserably. She won. At age 4, I finally caved in and my daughter started living full time as a girl. And ever since then, 6 years on, she's happy as clam, thriving, all is good. The thing about her, though, is she is super, super private about the fact that she's transgender. And she's largely under the radar at school. She's what we call stealth. Only a few of her friends know, her teacher knows, but that's about it. And that's by her choice. She is pretty worried about being teased or bullied or even just being treated as different if the other kids know. She's like, I just don't want to be the transgender girl at school. I don't want people pointing me out or talking about me, even if they're not saying anything mean, which I get. And so I really try to respect that. And I've agreed that I won't tell anyone that she's transgender without her permission, unless there's like a real safety issue where the adults in charge need to know, or, you know, if we have a sleepover, I tell the other parents because I think that needs to happen. But I always involve her in the process. So here's my fail. That's my little prologue. My fail is that 2 years ago, I met this amazing man and I'm getting married this summer. But about a year ago, we visited his family. They live in France. And in France, unfortunately, this is just not a topic that anyone talks about. A lot of Europe is kind of in diapers on the transgender issue, and especially on the issue of transgender kids. It's just not even on the radar. So when we visited the family, and I was thinking I was getting pretty serious about this guy, I thought that they should know. I wanted to sort of make sure they understood what this meant, that I had a transgender child. And I also wanted to see what I was getting into to make sure, you know, if they're going to be involved in our lives and they're not supporting who my daughter is, then that was going to be a big problem. Fortunately, it went fine. They were great and it was a non-issue. But the fail is that I didn't run it by my daughter before I told them. And after we got engaged and started planning a wedding and the family from France is going to come, she started getting super excited because they have there's a little girl in the family who's her age, and she was all excited that she was going to have a little French cousin. And she said, Mom, I want to wait until they come for the wedding and meet them before we tell them that I'm transgender. And I just felt terrible. I just like, damn it. And I was real quiet, and then a couple days later, I was like, honey, I'm sorry, I already told them. You know, I just feel bad because she wanted to meet them just as herself, not as like, you know, she wanted to be like the cool American cousin and not the transgender cousin. And now there's this sort of filter through which they'll see her before they meet her. And I know they'll accept her and it'll be fine. But I did feel bad for taking that out of her control. And You know, it's just something it's a line that I'm constantly walking between allowing her to have control over who has her private information and then also kind of wanting to keep her safe. And, you know, because sometimes people need to know. And also, in this case, of course, it wasn't an issue of safety, but just wanting to test the waters before I toss her into them.
Mm. Yeah.
In this case, I wish I'd done it differently.
Right.
But she did forgive me. She was, like, nice to me about it.
But that is a different kind of safety, isn't it? Like, if you don't know how this other family mm-hmm. is going to respond to this information, then presumably you wanted to find out before it was, like, game time for her.
True. But I still wish I'd just run it by her in advance, because usually I'll say, hey, how about we tell so-and-so because, you know, they may not know about this. Then we don't have to deal with it when we first meet them. It's just done. And she'll pretty much always buy my argument. So, you know, this girl has a lot of awareness about the fact that she's likely to be rejected by certain people. And she thinks about it a lot. So I like to let her be part of the whole thing. I think that's her right, frankly. Mm. Yeah. So I wasn't catastrophic. She was cool with it. She's accepted it. But she did get to lose some of her power there. That kind of bummed me out.
Did you think, like, is there, I guess I'm curious about, did you think about telling her before you made the decision not to, or did it fully slip your mind, or was there that brief moment where you were sort of like, I could tell her, but she might say no, and I'm not sure, I don't know. Like, how did it come to pass that you ended up telling the family without running it by her first?
You know, I think I just was not thinking. I just didn't really think it through. You know, and sometimes sometimes it's hard to keep up with our kids. They're getting, you know, when she was younger, I didn't run it by her as much because she was a little kid. And I think I'm trying to catch up with the fact that she's almost a tween. And she has the ability to track on this and make decisions about it. And I think the more I make sure and give that power to her, I think the better she's going to feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds totally right.
It was kind of not really keeping up with my growing kid, you know?
Yes, it's funny you say that. I actually feel like I have a lot of moments like that where I used to just sort of parentally make a decision on my own and not involve the kids. And then I did that one time more, and then they were like, well, why didn't you run it by me? And I'm like, oh, my God, you're older now. Like, that actually matters now.
Right.
Yeah, I totally
get
that.
Yeah.
It's always nice. Yeah. When your kid recognizes, you tried. just
right.
Don't do
she
it
knows
again
I have,
now.
You know, her best interest in mind, at least, you know. Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Before we move on, let's do the business. As always, if you have a question for us, you can leave us a message at 424-255-7833 or send us an email at momanddad@slate.com. Just to remind you, our Facebook presence has moved. We're now in the Slate Parenting Facebook group. Go to Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. Lots of great discussion happening there. On Slate Plus today, we have a bonus triumph from Slate editor Sam Adams. You can hear the story of his indoctrination of his daughter into the world of pop music on the Slate Plus segment today. To hear that segment and another like it every week, sign up for Slate Plus, just $35 for your first year. You help cover the cost of producing this show, and in return, you get an extended ad-free version of our show and all your other favorite Slate podcasts every week. So if you would like to support us, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, back to the show. Okay, before we get to our first question, I just want to give Marlo a chance to say a little bit about her podcast, How to Be a Girl. Marlo, we got this question from a listener who has a son who's transgender. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because this is an experience that you talk about very insightfully and from experience on your show. Could you just tell folks a little bit about How to Be a Girl and how that podcast works?
Sure. Yeah. How to Be a Girl is a podcast that I produce out of my daughter's bedroom, surrounded by stuffed animals that provide nice acoustic padding. It's a podcast about a mother and daughter, and the daughter is transgender. I started it when she was 6 years old. Now she's 10. And we just tell stories from our lives. I interview her a lot. She talks about her experience of being trans, and I talk a lot about the challenges of parenting a transgender child, which really has more to do with dealing with the rest of the world, not her challenge. The challenges of her are pretty much regular kid challenges most of the time. The podcast grapples sort of with the questions of what in the world gender actually is, which ends up being a question that I have not found very many good answers for yet. I'm still working on that.
It's a great show, and you can find it by searching for How to Be a Girl on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, this question came to us over email. It's being read to us by Slate's Browbeat intern, Lena Wilson.
Hi, Mom and Dad. My son, Ellis, who's 16, lives with me and my husband and visits his dad occasionally since he lives in another state. Their relationship is tense, always has been, because they both struggle for control. His dad wants to have control over Ellis's decisions. Here's the tricky bit. Ellis is transgender. He was born a she and has transitioned over the last 18 months to using male pronouns and the male name Ellis. No medical changes have been made yet. The transition is okay with me. It has not been without its challenges. Therapy works wonders. But he knows that I love and accept him no matter what, and we are close. Ellis left high school to make the transition to male easier and start college, where he is thriving academically. He is still struggling a little bit physically since he has some feminine traits. He would like to take testosterone to minimize the feminine traits. He has been asking for this for a year, and we have seen a few doctors that agree that it is mostly safe. There are risks, of course, and we understand the risks. His father will not allow it. He has many reasons, and when we provide a solution, he develops a new reason. This seems to be a control issue. My son is determined to take testosterone when he turns 18, at which point he will be going away to college and not living at home. And I would like him to be allowed to start taking it sooner so that I can monitor the progress while he is still at home and help him regulate dosing and side effects with a doctor. It will be a big change, and since he's determined to take it when he turns 18 anyway, I want him to be in the safety of my home when he starts. Once he leaves for college at 18, I won't have the close proximity anymore to do so. I'm willing to take him back to family court over this, but I feel unsure if I should. Do I go to bat for this? Help. Laura.
Marla, what would you say to someone in Laura's situation?
Well, first of all, I'd say to the mom, good job for listening to your kiddo and supporting him. A lot of parents aren't able to do that, so you're already doing a great job. And I'm really sorry that you have this tough conflict with your child's father. My overwhelming, overriding thought here is that this needs to be about your child and preserving his safety and happiness. I think we need to keep in mind that being transgender is not some kind of fad or trend, and I'm sure the mother is fully aware of this, that if you are transgender, it is phenomenally uncomfortable and even excruciating to live in a body that doesn't match your gender identity. And if you're not trans, and I'm not, I think this is really hard to relate to, hard to understand just how profound this is. But I've witnessed it over and over again with kids like mine and teens, transgender teens and transgender adults. So, you know, it's no joke. I mean, just as related to that, my daughter, when she was 4 years old, said she realized that she might end up growing a beard like her father one day and was horrified and terrified. And I had to reassure her at age four that, you know, when the time came, if she needed it and wanted it, the doctors could give her medicine to make sure she didn't grow up into a man. She's asked me over the years pretty regularly, you know, Mama, do I need the medicine yet? Do I need the medicine yet? I'm sure this mother is on top of that and understands that. And I'm sure she also is aware that for transgender youth, the rates of suicide and self-harm are just frighteningly high, and something like 9 times the general population. But the kids who are supported in their transition do a lot better and are a lot safer. So, giving this child the testosterone could constitute a life-saving medical intervention. This is really serious. But my question for the mother, I guess, would be, you know, how is your son doing and how much pain is he in? Does he feel like he can wait till he's 18? Or is that just, you know, at that age, that might just seem like an eternity, and that might constitute just some really, a really intolerable level of discomfort. I don't know about, you know, she didn't make it real clear in that. She did say that, you know, in her email that her son was uncomfortable with having the feminine traits. I would say that if the child's doctors and therapists agree that it's appropriate to have testosterone now, and if the child is really suffering, I would go the distance. I'd pull out all the stops to make that happen. The thing about going to court, of course, you know, it sounds like she may be in a position to do that economically. It's going to be no fun, and she may not win. A lot of judges are not aware of this issue, or they're conservative, and they just are not supportive of transgender youth. So there's no guarantee that going to court is going to go your way. It kind of depends what part of the country you're in, frankly, and just the luck of the draw on the judge. You know, even if you don't win, I think it's a pretty powerful message you're sending to your kid, that you're willing to go to bat for him, and, you know, saying to him, "Look, I'm in this with you. I'm willing to fight for you." Now, on the other hand, if the kid's not, you know, really, really suffering and says, "Well, I could wait, Mom," that's kind of more complicated. Then you are weighing like the costs, the relative stresses and risks of waiting versus this really messy battle with the dad. And that's just a really hard answer. I'd talk a lot with my kid. I'd talk with the therapist and the doctors, and that's a tough call. But I'd say whatever you do decide, you're doing a really good job. And I think your kid knows that. Your kid knows already that you have his back, and that's going to make all the difference no matter what you decide. So good job, Mom.
There's something real specific in the letter where she says, "I want him to start on the testosterone now while he's still living at mm-hmm. home, so that we have those two
right,
years
right, right.
to deal with the side effects and make sure to get the dosage right before he goes away to college. And then, mm-hmm. You know, he's not under my supervision, and I'm worried about the danger that he won't, you know, get the medication right when he's away at college."
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's really the concern. If I mean, you know, maybe the kid is in whatever way, like, can't be 100% trusted to go to the doctor and check in and make sure that the symptoms mm-hmm. and the side effects aren't getting out of control and so on. It makes me wonder if the mom is very, you know, is worried about, has plenty of things to worry about, because you've got a kid who's in a difficult situation, and then the other parent is not sympathetic to that kid. That is a plenty worrying situation. And then the kid is about to go off to college, which is worrying for every parent, no matter what kind of kid they have. Yeah. But so I wonder if the sort of haste to start on the testosterone, as you point out, maybe it comes from the kid and the kid's sense that I really need this medical intervention right away, in which case then, as you say, you should listen to that. But if it doesn't come from the kid, if it comes from the mother's own anxieties, then you might want to look at those anxieties a little more and see if precipitating a big explosive conflict with the father rather than letting the kid wait for a couple years and then start the testosterone himself with the care of hopefully a very good doctor at the college where he goes or in whatever town he moves to. See if that might be an option as well. If the issue is really primarily about the mother's anxieties. What do you think about that?
Didn't they say the kid had been asking for it for a year?
It does say that. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And to me, that sounds like a long time.
Yeah.
To make a young person wait who's been pretty consistent about saying who they are. But it's a good point about the mother's anxiety as well.
The other thing that occurs to me is, like, would there be, medically, is there a benefit to him from starting that part of the transition earlier? Like, does it help to start at 16 rather than 18?
You know, I don't know. That's really a question for a doctor, for an endocrinologist. But I would say the psychological benefits are just as significant, really, to relieve that dysphoria, that body dysphoria that this young man is obviously suffering from. And when you're 16, a year, waiting a year or so is a long time.
It's true.
He's already waited a year, so You know, a lot of kids are waiting around for their parents to get it together, to stop fighting, for mom and dad to stop fighting about this. For them to catch up when the kid has usually known for years. Even often teenagers will figure this out and be online and have basically researched and become little experts on everything trans. And by the time they tell the parents are like, oh, this is so fast. But a lot of times these kids have been trying to tell their parents for years. And it's they have to wait on their parents very often, and it's tough for them. I mean, I feel for the parents, of course. I mean, I feel even for the dad in this situation. I don't agree with him, but it's scary. It's scary when this kind of a change and medical interventions. They sound, you know, any kind of medical intervention with our children is very frightening. But I don't believe it's warranted in this case. This sounds like a case where this kid knows who he is, and this mom has been doing due diligence with getting the therapy, talking to the doctors. They're not just making this decision on a whim.
Well, yeah, I mean, you guys said everything that I was thinking. I mean, the strongest feeling I have about this is that the primary, like, you know, I always talk about putting things in order, like there's competing important things, but the most important thing here for me has to do with a child that needs protection and care, like that a child needs to feel like that people have their back, and that at least one person has their back in a truer and more useful sense than maybe everyone else does, who says, hey, I love you so much, you mean so much to me, but sort of like does things that are counter to that, at least from the kid's perception. And I guess the main thing, I mean, I think the thing I always, whenever we talk about like parents going to court, which is the real logistical question here, or one half of the logistical questions, I generally lean towards avoid that if you can, because no kid deserves to see their parents fighting each other in court, because it just gets so bad. And if there's any way you can sidestep that or go around it, I generally advise try to find another path. In this case, however, I was thinking that same thing that Marlo said, which is that putting aside for a moment the logistical cost of going to court, I was thinking that the need for a child to feel like at least one parent will go to any length to protect them, especially in this situation in which there is so little protection and so much risk.
Yeah.
To me, that strikes me as being worth seriously considering going to court. That's where I would go counter to my own general impulse to try and avoid it if possible. Even though it's true, it's the luck of the draw. And depending on where these people are in the country, which isn't stated in the letter, it could be a David versus Goliath kind of situation, because a lot of people have a lot of weird antiquated ideas about kids and gender, and because gender is so essential and everything, and this is the whole world is men and women, and you're corrupting the youth, and this way that people feel that it's this like fundamental violation of the natural order of things makes people behave in really bizarre and intense ways. And so a lot of people feel that way around, especially when kids and they're being indoctrinated into this new world and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's the luck of the draw. But I feel like the one of the main things that is really that you're really getting across to your kid here is that you are 100% willing to fight for their right to be who they really are. And that strikes me as the most important thing. If it's financially and logistically feasible for you to go to court. Because I think that, you know, this dad, it doesn't say much about what his motivations are, but it sounds like he just is uncomfortable with it and doesn't like it and doesn't know how to deal with the reality of this situation and is trying to roadblock it. But he can't. You cannot roadblock this because you can try, but ultimately your child's life is theirs, and they will take it from you some one way or other. That's just the nature of things. And that's a really difficult position for the child to be in, and a really difficult position for the mom to be in. And so I just feel like that, I think it's my guess, and I haven't been in this particular experience, although I've been in things not dissimilar. And I haven't parented in this particular experience, although many of my closest friends have. And it feels to me like, you know, the damage that comes from having a person who's supposed to be your primary caregiver or a primary caregiver and person who loves you, the damage that comes from having that person repeatedly and aggressively deny who you are is great. That damage is great. This father is, even though his position is, I do have sympathy for him. The impact on the child is damaging, I think, in a very specific, painful way. And I think part of the mother's responsibility is to try is to really defend and protect her child as much as she can. So those are the main things that I take away from this. I too don't know, and I would love to know if this is a. I was curious about this thing about like if they. I want the testosterone to happen now, because I want to be able to monitor how it goes, and I don't want him to be taking it alone in college where the side effects could be crazy and no, there's no person there loving, there's no loving committed person there to help take care of that. That did stop me. I wondered if that was true, if that was a real logistical concern, or if that was like a kind of a container for the mother's just generalized anxiety, which is valid and understandable, but I don't know the answer to that. That did strike me too.
One thing I'm sort of taking from what both of you have said is that, you know, this is a 16-year-old boy, and as Marla said, he knows who he is. And the mom hopefully is in a position to ask him whether it means more for her to go to war with the father on this issue, or for her to, you know, console him and help him in whatever other ways he can, and then he goes off to college and starts taking the medicine. He probably has a better sense than any of us do how much it means for her to, you know, go into battle on his behalf versus to, you know, do whatever else she can. So hopefully this is a decision, as Marlo said, that can be made primarily by the kid who's at the center of it.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Time to move on to our next question. This one also came by email. It's signed to Responsible Non-Negligent Parents, and it's being read again by Lena Wilson.
Dear Mom and Dad are Fighting, my husband and I have a question about whether it is an acceptable parenting decision to leave an 18-month-old alone in the house for 30 minutes while asleep in his crib at midnight. Here's the context. I travel for work for 2 days every 2 to 3 weeks, and my return flight arrives around midnight every time. We live in a safe, sleepy little town. It is a 12-minute drive from our house to the airport. I text my husband when the wheels are down, and he will be there waiting by the time I get out front. I never check luggage, and there's no traffic on these roads at midnight, so there's no reason the round trip would ever take more than a half hour. Every time we do this, he pulls our soundly sleeping toddler out of his crib, straps him into the car seat, makes the trip, pulls him back out of the car seat, and puts him back in the crib. This is often disruptive to his sleep, and it can take a while to get him back down again when we get home. So, is it okay for him to be left alone sleeping in the house for 30 minutes every other week? Practically, the answer seems to be yes. He consistently sleeps through the night, and if he did wake up, he's unable to climb out of his crib and has never attempted to do so. The odds of the house burning down during that time are pretty darn low, as are the odds of someone breaking into our home in our safe, sleepy little town. Honestly, the odds of anything that we could possibly think of happening seem infinitely less than the odds of a car accident during the round-trip journey to and from the airport. So, is it okay to leave him? And if not, why not? As a note, we're not looking for alternate solutions to the problem. Yes, maybe a friend could come to the airport or watch our kiddo, etc. We are really interested in the question of whether there's any real reason not to let him sleep while we are gone for 30 minutes in the middle of the night. Thanks so much. Love the show. Yours, two responsible, non-negligent parents.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, go. What the hell is this?
Isn't that illegal?
No. Yeah. I mean, yes, of course. Like, no, don't leave your 18-month-old alone at home. Like, how is that? How
in the middle of the night?
Yeah. How is that even a question? What is this? What is the meaning of
this? I love this question. I want to thank these responsible, non-negligent parents for this question, because while the answer is obvious, like, no, of course you can't do that. What the hell are you thinking?
What the hell?
It is very interesting to think about why, right? Like, the kid will almost certainly be fine. Almost certainly almost nothing certain. Bad will happen. So why do we all unanimously feel 100% like, no, absolutely not, under no circumstances can you do this?
That's an easy question, and here's the answer to it. Okay, sure, there's a chance that anything can happen to anyone at any time, and your kid is in the car, and a piano could fall in the car from a piano moving plane, or any weird shit can go down. That's all a real thing. However, if something happens in your house that is unexpected while you are gone and your 18-month-old is in a crib that he can't climb out of, I don't care if the odds of that thing happening were less than the odds of some other thing happening. That is not the way parenting is supposed to go under any circumstances. You will never live that down. You will never get over that. That is like negligence of the highest order. You are supposed to be with your child. That is like, okay, like bad shit can happen whether or not you're with them, but you cannot leave them alone because of that. Hey, like, hey, bad thing's going to happen if they were with me. So, hey, c'est la vie. What do you do? Like, what the fuck is this? No, you can't do this. And I also, the other reason this letter is frustrating is like, they're like, we don't want to hear alternative solutions. And it's like, well, why not? I mean, this is like, you don't, why are you insisting on painting this bizarre, this bizarre situation from which you can't escape? Take a cab. Do they not have, you live in a sleepy little town.
Uber?
Do they not have Uber? Do they not have cabs? Like, take a cab. Right. I mean, I get it. Even if you don't, for some reason, don't do that, or you live in a town that's so small that there's no fee for service driving, I'm sorry, wake the kid up. I'm sorry. If it's only once a night every other week, then wake the kid up. That's far preferable. Far, far preferable. A million times more preferable than leaving an 18-month-old alone in a crib that they can't climb out of in the middle of the night. That is insane. Oh, that's insane.
And you know that kid's going to learn to climb out of it as soon as they leave him alone.
Obviously. How will you know when he's learned to climb out of it? Like, you know what I mean? This is, I can't even with this. Go ahead. Someone else say something because I'm done.
So I think you're right that the issue is, I do find it mostly interesting to interrogate why it is that we are all, including myself, think that this is a completely unthinkable course to take. I think it is to do with like the image of an 18-month-old alone unsupervised. It just violates a powerful taboo that like the point isn't, the rule isn't you must always keep your kids safe from harm because that's impossible. The rule isn't you must always do the least dangerous thing that has the greatest chance of minimizing harm to your kid because that's not how we do things. The rule is you have to keep your kid with a trusted adult. You have to have someone there in charge because the kid is too little to be without a person in charge. I don't know why that's the rule. And the rule isn't you have to do the harm minimizing thing, but that's not the rule. The rule is there has to be an adult in charge all the time.
I think it's a visceral thing too. You know, I was sort of speechless when I heard this one. It got me right in the gut. Like, no, you can't leave your baby. And I don't even know how to explain why. The other thing that hit me, and I guess I feel kind of cranky about it, is, you know, that's sort of preachy, but as parents, there's all sorts of things that would make our lives easier and our kids would probably enjoy, but that doesn't mean we get to do them. My kid cried basically all night long for the first year of her life. I mean, I didn't sleep for a year. Mm. And I bet we both would have loved it if I just gave her some Ambien or maybe some laudanum, you know, like back in the Victorian
right.
era.
Right.
But you just can't do that. And it sucks. It really sucks to have to wake up your baby and drive to the airport. And it sucks that I didn't sleep for a year. And that's just kind of what you signed up for. I mean,
yeah, seriously.
Just how it is.
Yeah. This is, yeah.
Yeah.
No. I mean, it is. I understand that it may even be, just to give these people the benefit of the doubt, it may be that they're really just writing in to ask about a philosophical question, like a philosophical kind of,
right,
like,
right.
And because they're curious, because a conversation sprang up between them about why this is. But, and so I think Gabe's right. It is interesting why the answer is no. I think we all agree that the answer is no, and that should never be questioned. I think it is interesting to question why the answer is no. And my gut instinct is that it has to do with just the basic responsibility of parenting, which is that you are there. You are not there. And just because something can happen as easily with you there or not there doesn't justify not being there for a child at this age I'm talking about. And like, Yes, you're right. The visual image of an 18-month-old. The first image I thought when I read this question was when they said he can't climb out of the crib, or he or she, I forgot what they said, but when they said the kid can't climb out of the crib, my first thought was, well, what if they need to climb out of the crib for safety? What if you need to get them out of the crib? Like, that's literally why you're there. The fact that they can't climb out of the crib isn't evidence that you shouldn't be worried. That's another reason you need to be there. You need to be there because they can't climb out of the crib, and then you need to be there because they can. You need to be there because nothing, because mm-hmm. something might happen, and you need to be there because nothing might happen, but it, you know what I mean? Like, you just need to be there. That is just the basic thing. And you need to, you need to be there to do stuff for them that they can't do for themselves, and you don't know what all the stuff is. So whatever you're thinking, all the things you're thinking of, you haven't thought of everything. That's why you need to be there.
Right, that piano might fall out of the sky out of that piano moving plane.
Exactly.
Onto the house.
You did not think of that until I said it. But like, you can't think of everything, and that's why you need to be there to think of things in the moment. And the way I know that's the case is because that rule changes once we know that the kids can manage thinking of, like, managing surprise situations on their own themselves. When they're like 12 and we leave them alone at home for like 20 minutes while we go to the grocery store, or when they're 14 and they come home from school and we know the reason that they're allowed to do that at 12 and 14 and maybe even in some cases 9 and 10 and they're not allowed to do that at 18 months is because they now have the capacity to handle unexpected situations. We know that they can respond to things that neither us nor they have thought of. We know that now because they've proven that. So at 18 months, the fact that you can't think of any bad thing that can happen doesn't justify not being there, because bad things can happen that you haven't yet thought of. That's just the fact of it. That's why you have to be there. This is crazy.
The more we talk about this, the more I feel like it comes down to a primal taboo rather than anything rational. I really do start to feel that, because this is one of those things where the dangers of driving fuck up any attempt to think about any other danger, right? Like, it's definitely true that putting your kid in the middle of the night in the car seat and driving to the airport and back on the highways in the night in a relatively remote location, it's definitely true that, like, we can all imagine the chances of the kid getting killed in a car accident in that situation. And yet we're saying that's the responsible thing to do. And the irresponsible thing to do, we all agree, is to leave the kid alone in the house, which we're willing to stipulate with this letter writer, is probably statistically safer for the kid. It must be that there's a primal taboo against leaving a child alone without adult supervision, leaving an 18-month-old alone without adult supervision. And you can see why there would be that taboo. You can see why in all sorts of ancestral environments, the fundamental rule would be keep the kids close. Don't let the kids get too far away. If you have to go away from the kid, make sure there's somebody else who's watching the kid. If it's not you, then it's your mother, or it's somebody, some other trusted adult from your group. But those kinds of taboos are very powerful, and we're all, me included, having a powerful response to the taboo. And on our Facebook group, when we post this episode, I look forward to seeing everybody else have a very powerful response to the primal taboo of leaving an 18-month-old alone in a house while you go to the airport to pick up your wife. And I'm not advocating that anybody should violate that taboo, but I am saying it's fundamentally not a rational rule. And if you want to violate all of the norms of human life and society and do the thing that rationally has some infinitesimally greater chance of safety versus this other infinitesimally more dangerous course of action, which is socially approved, of putting your kid in the car and driving to the airport in the middle of the night, I'm not going to say go for it, because I don't want to condone violating this taboo. But I can understand how a certain kind of hyper-rational mind might choose to make that decision.
Yeah, okay. That's all I have to say about that.
Just go to facebook.com and search for Slate Parenting, and you can join our Facebook group and let us know what you think about leaving an 18-month-old in a house by himself. We'll see you there.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. It's the time on the show when we do recommendations. That's when we tell you things that we like and enjoy, or our kids like and enjoy. Marlo, do you have a recommendation for the folks?
I do. And at the risk of completely typecasting myself, I'd like to recommend a few books for little kids about transgender and gender nonconforming children. This is a subject dear to my heart. Not just, well, I do have a transgender daughter, but I am struck by how often parents I encounter are just completely tongue-tied about how to talk to me about this, and especially how to talk to their own children about just the mere existence of my daughter. They seem to think, you know, even the ones who pretty much get what transgender is, a lot of them feel like it's just sort of encroaching too much on, like, that it has something to do with sex, or like that I'm asking them to, like, show their kids porn or something. So I just want to assure people that this is, you know, a completely G-rated topic, or it should be if you have young kids. It's certainly a G-rated topic in my house. Plus, your kid is going to be absolutely guaranteed going to be encountering transgender kids in school. And this, you know, now you'll be prepared and your kid will be all cool with it when they meet a kid like mine. So my recommendations are I Am Jazz by Jazz Jennings, It's Okay to Sparkle by Avery Jackson. And this is one my daughter told me this morning that was, she said, this one's super funny. You have to recommend this. It's called A Girl Like Any Other by Sophie LaBelle. One more is My Princess Boy by Cheryl Killa Davis, which is about, well, those first three are about young transgender girls, and those are appropriate for very young kids. My Princess Boy is about a little boy who's not trans. He's totally cool with being a boy, but he loves princesses. And there's lots of boys like that, and I think they all need this book. One more, there happen to be a lot more there's a lot more books about little boys who are transgressing gender norms than there are little girls. And I think that's fairly easy to explain, because, you know, girls who love ninjas, they are like praised for being tomboys, and boys who love princesses, we book them therapy appointments. So I think we have a lot more work to do on that. And one more book is great for just sort of overall introducing your kids to this topic and starting conversations about gender is called Who Are You? A Kid's Guide to Gender Identity. So that's my whirlwind tour of transgender literature for your young child. And I highly recommend adding some of these books to your library if you have little kids or if you teach them.
That's awesome. And we will put links to all those books on our show page on slate.com.
Thanks.
Carvel, how about you?
I am going to recommend a blast from the video game past, which is Nintendo Wii and Wii Resort, which is a great thing to get now because you can get them for nothing. And the way this came back into our life is that longtime listeners of the show will remember that Ezra had a PS4 that he bought with his own money, which was our money, but we gave it to him over the course of Christmases and so forth. And then he then lost access to that when his GPA dropped below 2.5, and that was one of the things. And then he was really bummed about that. And then he sort of like started developing other interests, which was kind of the secret idea. And then he decided that he couldn't live without some video game system, so he bought a Nintendo Wii for like $30 off of eBay, which is what they're going for right now. And we were just like, this is such a loophole move by a 15-year-old to be like, well, you didn't say I couldn't have this system, haha. And we were kind of irritated. He didn't do it with, he did it without telling us, and then it just arrived. And then he was like, oh yeah, I bought this Nintendo Wii. And at first we were like, oh, and then we started playing it with him. And the thing about Wii that's so much better than any other video game system is that it's like family stuff. Like it's turned into a whole thing. Like he's been progressing along. He has Wii Resort, which has a ping pong game, and he's been progressing along along the ping pong path. And like, I don't know why it is so fun for us to watch each other play. We don't even play each other. We just watch each other play. And making the little me, the little avatars for everyone in the family was so fun. And I don't know why it works, but it just, it's the one video game system that seems to like bring us together as a family, which is much different than like sitting there watching him play like Red Dead Redemption or something and like work his way through weird like criminal underworld Old West narratives, which is nice. He and I can kind of bond over that, but this Wii thing is just much more inclusive. And so I don't know if you feel like you have little kids between, you know, 8 and up, and you sort of like want to do something that's kind of video gamey, but you don't want to go down the whole path of like, you know, Iron Death Blade of Murder Part 7, then I recommend Nintendo Wii because they're cheap and kind of low stakes at this point.
That's really good.
My daughter loves the Resort one too.
I'm going to recommend another game, a physical board game. It's for young kids. It's Richard Scarry's Busy Busy Airport game. If you, like me, are a fan of the Richard Scarry books, or even if you're not, the games that have been made out of his books are weirdly well designed as games. Like they don't, they're not just like, okay, roll the dice and you move your little Richard Scarry circle like 6 places along the path and whoever gets to the end of the path wins, which every time we try to play a game, it's that kind of pure randomness of rolling a dice or spinning a dial game, and it drives me completely nuts, and the kids lose interest in it too. The Richard Scarry games are really well designed, and the airport one, everybody gets their own airplane and they fly all over the board to different destinations and they collect different souvenirs and they have their list of their itinerary, and it winds up being a thing that everybody is able to continue paying attention to for the length of time that it takes to play the game, which when one of your kids is under 4 and the other one is over 7, it's often very hard to find a single game that can unite both of those children and also an adult who can play all the way through to the end without succumbing to a horrible fit of depression. So if you have any interest in board games, Richard Scarry, Busy Busy Airport. And that is our show. If you have a question that you want us to address, you can call us at 424-255-7833. You can let us know what you thought of the show and whether you would leave your kid alone in a house at 18 months at facebook.com/groups/Slate Parenting, or just go to Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. Marlo Mack, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marlo's show, once again, is How to Be a Girl. You can find that on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast directory. Our show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. Rebecca Lavoie will be back next week. For Carvel Wallace, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we will see you next week.